Many thanks for downloading the Culture Club podcast. I'm Anne Hall, standing in for Charlotte Green. And this week I was joined by Tom Morris from the Bristol Old Vic, Classic FM's brand new composer in residence, Debbie Wiseman, and the one and only sporting legend, Freddie Flintoff. Be still my beating heart. Not a bad Sunday afternoon, all in all. Andrew stroke Freddie, it is an honour and a privilege and a great pleasure for me to meet you because I'm a huge, huge cricket fan. The first match I ever saw was Botham making his debut in a test against the Australians with my dad. And ever since then, I've been absolutely hooked on
it's
the
not
game.
A bad one, that is it?
Ian it was
Botham,
all right.
Ian Botham's first test match.
It was amazing. So I want to start by asking you, what first drew you into the game?
I was lucky, really, because I went to a school on an estate in Preston and we didn't play cricket at all. I had to play football, then I didn't get beat up for playing cricket because cricket was seen as like the posh kid sport. But it was my dad just played on a Saturday afternoon. He was captain of a local second team. My mum would go and do the teas, my nan and grandpa would go, my auntie Ennis, my uncle Ted. And me and my brother from like babies would push around the boundary and then we'd play on the side and then we'd play in the nets and it just started from there. I think I played my first game for the under-14s when I was 6. They were short. My brother was playing. And since that day, that's all I ever wanted to do. I just wanted to play cricket. I'm not really into other sports. I just really like cricket.
And it's not the most straightforward, I would imagine, of career paths to head for, is it? I mean, what did your careers teacher at school say? You should have a backup plan or something.
She was saying, if you can do anything, it'll be a bonus. It was funny because I started playing senior cricket when I was about 10 in adult teams. And then when I was 15, I played for Lancashire Reserves. And at the end of the week, I got a brown envelope with £55 in for a match fee. And I thought, this is all right. And I got like 15 quid petrol money from my dad. And I didn't realise up until that point that this is actually a job as well. I didn't realise you got paid to play cricket. I thought it was just something that people do. So from then it was like, well, I'm doing all right at school, but I'm really not bothered now because I can get paid to play cricket. And when I went in my careers meet and I said I was playing cricket, and I think she'd heard it all before, but a lot of the kids had said footballers. I think she was just pleased to get me out of the room. And then when I left school, my first job, I worked behind the record counter at Woolworths because I wanted to go to Australia and play cricket at 16, but my mum said, you're too young, get a job, because I didn't start getting paid till the next April. So I worked behind the record counter, which I loved, actually. I loved it.
In terms of the difference between county cricket and playing for your country, so there you are perhaps playing in front of hundreds of people, hopefully, yeah, for a good county, and then suddenly, bang, you're either facing up to your first ball or you're bowling your first ball of the opening over of a test match in front of 20,000 people. So there's a chasm, do you think?
At first it is, but then as my career went on, I found it easier playing for England than I did playing for Lancashire. Because playing for England, it sounds awful, but it became the norm. Because you'd turn up and you'd play in front of a crowd. You'd play in front, like in India, you'd play in front of 100,000 people. At Lords, you'd like 25,000. It was amazing. And then you play for England and then you go back to your county. And because playing for Lancashire meant so much, you tried to do everything. You wanted to perform so well every time. I used to put myself under so much pressure. And when you're playing in front of a smaller crowd, you can hear every comment that's made from the crowd as well. And they weren't always that flattering. So it just echo around the ground. So the England days were probably easier than the Lancashire ones. I think county cricket gets such a bad rap when it's a real tough competition.
They're a witty lot, aren't they, the cricket crowd?
Come on.
No, I mean, there's good banter. There's good banter that goes on.
There is, yeah. They do let you know what you're thinking. I remember I played a test match against the West Indies at Lords and I was walking through the long room and it was the last over before lunch and I went out to bat. I hit my first ball for 6 and I was out second ball. And then as I was walking back through the long room in front of all the posh people, I got knocked round the head by a rolled up telegraph. This member in like a stripy jacket and red trousers just whacked me around the head with a telegraph and said, oh, that was fun while it lasted, Flintoff. And I turned around and I pulled my hand back. I thought, what are you doing? And then this old fellow just scuttled off through the long room.
But disappeared. Yeah. He's probably dined on that for years.
Yeah, they described as a lot of things, but witty's the first, I think.
there was an article in one of the papers recently talking about, obviously with the Ashes this summer, about the best ever moments. And in the paper I picked up was a huge photograph of your good self talking about Edgbaston, the second test in 2005. And this writer, so it's all picked by journalists, who say that figures reveal only so much about a player's performance, whatever the sport. What matters most of all is the influence a player has on a game when it lies in the balance and in company of the highest class at the crucial moments. Flintoff's brilliance transformed this test.
Yeah. It's nice, isn't it? Is that from a cricket journalist?
Michael Henderson.
Is it? Oh, yeah. I like Hendo. I get on really well with Michael, yeah. He's a good lad, Michael.
What are your memories now, I mean, looking back at that extraordinary game?
I don't know, to be honest. I never look back. I never sit around. I've never watched it. Having said that, about 4 mornings ago, I went in my son, my youngest, he's 7, Rocky, and he loves cricket. And I went in his bedroom and my wife had given him a DVD of me playing. And it's the first time he's seen something like that. And I awkwardly sat and watched that test match at Edgbaston. And there's me with my skinhead and looking a little bit younger. And my son was confused because there I was, like lying on his bed. He was looking at the screen and looking at me. And he had no comprehension, I think, that I used to do that. So I find it really strange. You know, I have memories. I have nice memories of it. But I think at the time when you was playing, you had no idea what you was involved in. You were just playing cricket. That's what you do. You know, you turn up, you play, you enjoy it. And then everyone writes it up and talks about it so fondly, which is nice. But I've never really got carried away with it, to be honest.
So here we are. You're about to embark on a whole new adventure. I mean, you've had so many in your career since playing for England and Lancashire. A one-man show. You're going to be in London, you're going to be in Edinburgh, yeah. You're going right around the country. You've been playing places already. Tell me how this particular journey began.
It's not quite one man. I've got my mate Clyde. He's doing it with me. Clyde, he's a TV producer. One of his big jobs is Sport Relief and Comic Relief. And we do a podcast together. And it's really rough. We just sit there, we have a computer, and we just talk. And it's never been edited, and we just put it out there. And people seem to like it. So we jokingly set about doing a tour, and then before we knew it, it escalated, and we had these tour dates, and we're doing it. So we had to be a little bit more professional. We went round like the Hen and Chickens and the Tabard Theatre and the Waterloo East, doing it in front of really small audiences, like 50, 60 people, which was nerve-wracking. But a great warm-up, because when we got in front of some of the bigger ones, like we'd done Melton, I think it was 500, 600, it was fun. And we go in and we talk a little bit about cricket or things that are loosely cricket, more my exploits off the field or a lot of the things that I got wrong, even to the point of trying to find a girlfriend as a cricketer, which is not always the easiest thing to do. So it is cricket, but it's a lot of other things as well. And me and Clyde just enjoy doing it. And hopefully that the audience have had a sense of that. And then they just have a laugh with us. And a lot of it is like self-deprecating, talking about me, the things I constantly get wrong. But it's really good fun, something I never thought I'd be doing. But, you know, to get a chance to go to Edinburgh and do the festival and do, you know, the Palace in London, do my hometown, Preston Guildhall, it's great fun.
How do you feel before you go on stage? You're saying you never got nervous about playing for England and playing for England?
I always got nervous playing for England. I would hide it so well. I would make out in the dressing room that I don't have a nerve in my body, but inside, my stomach would be churning, my hands would be shaking. And when I used to walk out to bat, David Lloyd, who was my first coach at Lancashire and England, he said, when you walk out there as if you own it. Look at everyone in the eye. And I used to do that every time I walked out to bat, but at no point did I felt I owned anything. You know, I was really nervous. And the first couple of theatres we did, I was really nervous. You know, it's a real strange thing. You see, like, you've got this little montage before you go on, and once that started, you know, then you walk out in front of all these people clapping, and it's like entertainers. It's not throwing a ball or hitting at a catching one. It's actually got to talk. And it was nervy at the time. But now, having done a few, I really enjoy it.
And you're going to sample a bit more of Edinburgh when you've got time off from your shows to go and see what else is on and who else is playing?
Yeah, I hope so. I'm not quite sure what to expect. I've been to Edinburgh and it's beautiful, but I've never been to the festival. And everyone I bump into who speaks about it says it's amazing. There's just like thousands and thousands of acts and you can just go anywhere you want, watch a whole host of people. So I will be doing, because hopefully if this tour goes well, I'd like to do it again. I really like it. It's good fun.
One of my favourite pieces of music of all time, Jerusalem by Hubert Parry on Classic FM. Carl Davis looking after the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra and the voices of the Brighton Festival Chorus. And I played that this afternoon on the Culture Club because when I had the pleasure of meeting Freddie Flintoff before the start of the Ashes last week, he told me that that piece of music had a very special significance for him.
Especially 2005, I think it first started, where Jerusalem, as we walked out, there'd be a live performer singing Jerusalem as we went out onto the field, which was great, and the crowd used to get involved. And I remember in my first few test matches when David Lloyd was coach, he used to get these videos of the players, like field goal videos, and then he put it to like really big music, big classical music, building up, building up, building up. So, yeah, classical music isn't something which I'm a stranger to. I listen to it. I'm not quite sure what I'm listening to be honest. I couldn't tell you, like, all the artists.
Join the club.
But my middle son, well, my middle child, Corey, he's a sensible one out of us. And he listens to a bit of classical music sometimes. We'll be in the car and he'll say, can you put Classic FM on? And we'll put it on for a little bit. And then my daughter gets her away and we've got to listen to some other rubbish like Taylor Swift. But, yeah, no, I don't mind classic music.
Just two more things I want to ask you, Freddie, if that's all right. How much is it, as a cricketer, about having enormous individual talent and about as playing as a team? Or is it a combination of the two that can make or break a side?
It's a bit of everything, I think. I honestly don't think, as a player, I was immensely talented. My technique and everything was pretty basic, but I was quite stubborn. I think that's one of the reasons which I got on to the extent I did. However, you could be the best player in the world. You could have like all the ability, but if you can't play within a side, you're just not worth your weight. So you have to play in a team. And cricket's a strange sport in the fact that when you're out in the middle, if you're batting, it is only you. So it is still quite individual. But a nice thing is you get the comfort of a team as well. You got all your mates around you. So it's the best of both worlds. So the team's massive. I used to love being a part of it. When you sit down and you win a game at the end, and I'd be sat next to like Steve Armisen, one of my best mates, like after 2005. You know, I'm from Preston, he's from similar background in the northeast, and we just sat there thinking, you know, how did this happen? How have the two of us ended up playing in front of all these people, being Ashes winners? This is really strange, but for me, times like that were the best ones.
And how do you think the boys are going to get on this summer against the Australians after a really fantastic series against the Kiwis?
Oh, they'll beat them. They'll beat them, definitely. The Aussies are all right. There's nothing really that you think, you know, is going to put you off your breakfast. There's nothing like... And England, the series against New Zealand was perfect. New Zealand were like the perfect opponents to play against. They have a go. They're aggressive. And it seemed to rub off on England. We seemed to match them. And going into this series, because we have been so bad, you get beat 5-0, you have a shocking World Cup. And you have to change things. You've got to change the way you play. You've got to have a rethink. You know, we weren't in a position where we was doing all right and you're kidding yourself. It's like, hang on a minute, we are really bad. We've got to do something about this. And I've been in that position. And you just come back and I think they are doing. So I think end of the summer, I think we win this series 2 or 3-1. I desperately hope we will, because I keep telling everyone. But I look at the side, England, and we've got some of the best ever players who have played for England in that side. In Anderson, Cook, Bell, Butler's going to be amazing, Joe Root's great. So it's all going to be good, I think.
Freddie, can't wait for your show to begin. Second innings, can see you on the 20th. So best of British with it. And thanks so much. A pleasure to talk to you.
Thanks for having us. Thank you.
Now, Wednesday of this week, we announced that Debbie Wiseman is to be the brand new Classic FM composer in residence. Debbie is with me now. First of all, Debbie, congratulations. Tell us how this has come about and what challenges you're going to be facing as our brand new composer.
Oh, thank you, Anne-Marie. I'm so thrilled to be part of the Classic FM family and just to sort of take on this role. It's a lovely, lovely thing for me to do. I think I'm very excited because I'm so used to writing with pictures, to have a director, a producer, a story, a location, and a film to inspire the music that I write. And now what's happening is that through being the Classic FM composer in residence, I'm writing an album of music for you, which is inspired by the signs of the zodiac. It's the working title is The Musical Zodiac. So we go from Pisces to Taurus, and we go to Sagittarius and Virgo. And of course, every star sign has its own characteristics and personality traits. And I've been delving into it and looking into each of the star signs and finding what makes them tick. And it's fascinating. And so I will be writing a 12-movement suite, each inspired by the characteristics of the star sign. And that's going to be released on Classic FM next year, September. So there's quite a long time for me to write it and learn about the star signs. And it's absolutely fascinating. As you delve into it, the more interesting it is.
Now, I have to ask, I'm always fascinated about where composers begin. I mean, do you sit down at the piano? Do you sit down on a laptop? Do you sit down with pen and manuscript paper? What has been your starting point for this brand new project?
I always actually work the same, whether it's for a film or whether it's just for standalone music. I always work the same, which is sitting down at the piano with my manuscript paper, my pencil. That's it. Very simple, very old-fashioned, very, very basic. I do have around me in my music room samples, so I have samples and synthesizers and all kinds of technology, so that when I've sketched out my themes, which I do at the piano, I then orchestrate it in my head, and then I play them into my music software, which has got, you know, it's got everything on it. It's got flutes and oboes and clarinets and bassoons and horns and strings, and I build my orchestra. So I do, when I finished writing it in my head, when I popped it on manuscript paper in sketch form, I do then orchestrate it and play every instrument in so I can hear it almost as the audience and step back a little from the actual composition and listen to what I've composed.
Well, let's hear something now that you composed for the big screen. This is music from the movie Wild. Part of the soundtrack to that fantastic movie Wild, composed and conducted with her own studio orchestra by Debbie Wiseman, who is Classic FM's brand new composer in residence. So I've got to ask you, Debbie, we're talking about your time with us as our composer, that you're going to be influenced by the signs of the zodiac. So 12 pieces of music to make up a suite. What star sign are you?
I'm Taurus. So Taurus, as I now know, I'm going to be complete authority on star signs by the end of this project. At the moment, I'm not, of course, but I will be. But Taurus is industrious. They're good craftsmen. They're not afraid of getting their hands dirty, although that doesn't quite apply to me. But apparently, that's generally the rule. They're reliable, a gentle and even-tempered, but they dislike conflict. And if they're provoked, they can, at sometimes, on occasions, get very angry if they're provoked. Now, some of those traits do apply to me. And actually, other people I know who are also Taurus, similar as well. And it is interesting how so many people born on the same day or within the star sign, same star sign, do have similar personality traits. And when you delve into it, the more of them you discover. Which is just so interesting. What star sign are you, Anne-Marie?
I'm Cancer.
Ah, well, Cancer, as it happens. So you're 22nd of June to 22nd of July, okay. Actually, as I've found, that's the least clear-cut of all the signs of the zodiac.
Cancer breeze.
It can range from the quite timid and shy to the most brilliant. And I don't know if this applies to you, Anne-Marie, but for Cancer, I've found that people seem to find that there's a time to socialise and a time to be solitary, and that's part of the contradiction. I don't know if you find
I
that
do.
Within
that's,
yourself.
That rings many bells.
Outwardly, they can sometimes appear quite thick-skinned, but within their own family and friends and their own social circle, they are very sympathetic and able to empathise.
Ah, how interesting.
So there you go.
Now, I've got to ask you then, where have you started writing music for this project yet? And if so, which star sign has caught your attention first?
Well, I have started sketching ideas, and actually Pisces, which is my husband's star sign, I've started with that. That's people born between the 19th of February and the 20th of March. And Pisces can be escapist, idealistic, a little bit compassionate, kind, sometimes lack decisiveness, all those kind of things. But what's wonderful is when you talk about these traits, how you can also translate that into music. And that's what I'm finding really, really interesting. There's also a little bit of Greek mythology, which I'm discovering as I look into it. For example, Virgo. It's depicted as an angel with wings holding an ear of wheat. And the constellation Virgo is often said to personify Persephone. So according to the famous Greek myth, eternal spring once reigned upon the earth. And then the fateful day when the god of the underworld abducted Persephone, this radiant maiden of spring. Now that, to me, is very musical. And that sets me off on a little musical journey. And each one of these star signs has a little Greek mythological story behind it, which I'm delving into and then twisting it a little and making it my own. And I think that's because I'm so used to writing to picture. I'm so used to having a story to inspire the music that even when I write away from picture and I'm writing music just to be music to be heard on its own, the idea of having a story behind it is still really valuable and really inspiring. So I'm sort of making up my own stories based on the star signs, based on the characteristics and the traits of each one. And then this a little bit of mythology thrown in.
Well, we can't wait to hear the start of this project. I think it's going to be a fascinating 12 months and a fascinating piece of work to share with everyone who listens to Classic FM. Debbie, thank you so much for your time today. And listen, go for it.
Thank you, Anne-Marie. I'm really looking forward to working with you all.
Lovely music. It's called Romance and it was played by Craig Ogden. And you can join John Brunning, after me at 5 o'clock today to find out whether Craig can retain the number one place in the Classic FM chart with his latest album called Craig Ogden and Friends. But now let's turn our attentions to the Bristol Proms. Tom Morris is the artistic director of the Bristol Old Vic and he joins me in the Culture Club. Tom, first of all, welcome back to Classic FM. We are almost upon that time of year when it is time for Bristol Proms Week. Now, I am a first timer, very much looking forward to being there, as indeed are the rest of the team here at Classic FM. So tell me all about it. What's going to keep you there all week?
Well, the starting point for the Bristol Proms is, and really the reason it's become such a wonderful partnership with Classic FM and Universal as well, is that it's driven by a really simple love of high quality music and a sense of bewilderment that more people don't enjoy it and that people perceive going to a concert sometimes as being a sort of intimidating or alienating experience. So we do everything we can in the Bristol Proms to get the most exciting players on stage and to present them in a truly welcoming, interactive, informal atmosphere. And for people who've been before, that's achieved through a combination of this extraordinarily beautiful 18th century theatre. The Bristol Old Vic is, in fact, the oldest working theatre in Britain. And also Bristol is a place where there's a pioneering kind of artistic community working with digital technology. So it's a given that any concert that we put on is not only partly theatricalised, but also uses digital media to take the audience as close to the performance as possible and enhance the performance. Very often that's a kind of intelligent film relay, so you can see in close-up Daniel Hope playing his violin, see the kind of passion flying off him. And sometimes we commission artists to respond to the work visually so that you get something which is, we hope, a forward-looking, truly accessible, high-quality concert.
Well, Daniel Hope, you've mentioned one of the events taking place. He is bringing us the lives and the music of both Tchaikovsky and Brahms and the story of sort of the rivalry. And I sometimes think a little bit of friendship. There was a little bit of a friendship between the two of them. They had
there
a few boozy
was.
Lunches in their time. But tell us a little bit about that event.
Well, there's a kind of a theme which runs through this year's Bristol Proms, which is about the emotion that people find in music. A very simple theme, because we all know that music makes us cry like no other art form. working in theatre, most of my time I spend directing plays, and I know that you can do whatever you like to structure a story to engage an audience, but very often it's the music which actually releases the feeling in an audience. And of course that's especially true in film. And what we've done throughout the week is we've asked the artists we're working with to explore that in different ways. Daniel Hope's response was to pick these two great romantic composers who famously had spats and wrote rude things about each other and were in some ways on different sides of a kind of aesthetic divide. If you think about Brahms being a more structured composer and Tchaikovsky in some ways being a more expressive composer. I mean, that's a very broad brushstroke thing to say. And to explore their music from the point of view of its emotionality, almost as if the two great composers were talking to each other through their music. So you will hear Brahms's great quintet, you'll hear the Souvenir de Florence, the Tchaikovsky sextet, but also there'll be context where an audience can find out about the rivalry, the passions of the people who wrote the music.
Sounds great, Tom. So let's hear Daniel Hope in action now with a film favourite by Morricone. The music of Ennio Morricone's Cinema Paradiso, Daniel Hope on violin, and the conductor with the Royal Stockholm Philharmonic Orchestra, that was Alexander Shelley. Someone else also making an appearance at this year's Bristol Proms Week is the soprano Pumeza Machikiza. And this is an evening, Tom, called My Life in Song, and a real eclectic mix of music here. We'll hear music from her homeland of South Africa, plus some more familiar names to Classic FM listeners.
Yeah, so Pumeza, an extraordinary soprano, and kind of became known as the voice of the Commonwealth Games last summer. People might remember her singing at the opening ceremony for that. And she sang for us last year, singing Dido beautifully in a staging of Dido and Aeneas. And she's also a poet, and I didn't know this until I got talking to her. Someone who thinks very much about her music. And we asked her to choose a series of emotional situations and choose repertoire which explores those situations in a South African popular music idiom and in an operatic idiom. She'll be reading some of her poetry, and she'll also be singing some kind of Miriam Makeba-type South African song, and the romantic Puccini repertoire from opera for which she's well known now. We think it'll be an extraordinary evening.
It is a traditional song. It's called Hush My Baby. And singing on Classic FM, Pumeza Machikiza. And My Life in Song is one of the performances you can catch at Bristol Proms Week. And Tom Morris, the man behind it, is with me this afternoon. And Tom, I want to talk to you about Alison Balsam, the trumpeter, because you were saying earlier about how one of the things you want to get across to people who've perhaps not been to live concerts before is that not everything has to kick off at 7:30. You don't have to be in your finery. You don't have to know when to clap and where to sit and what to do. And this is a great example of a sort of a breakthrough performance, because Alison's having a late night concert with her trumpet and various friends on stage.
That's right. I mean, her concert is called Late Night Trumpet with Alison Balsam. So on the Wednesday night of the Bristol Proms, the Wednesday, the 29th of July, you can start out by listening to a wonderful cellist and violinist, Håkon and Mari Samuelsson. And then the late night event is Alison Balsam, and she's assembling a band in order to create really an experimental investigation of the voice of the trumpet. It will feature music of Bach by Britten Stravinsky, there will also be some elements of staging. And people who know Alison's music and who know her, she's an absolutely natural communicator. She's a real ambassador, if you like, for those musicians, those top-flight classical musicians who passionately believe that classical music needs to find new ways of communicating itself. Never any compromise on the music with her. It's absolutely beautifully, exquisitely played. But she's coming to the Bristol Proms because she wants to experiment formally. And we know that, she will be playing various different kinds of trumpet, from a tiny piccolo trumpet to, we think, a very, very, I won't say anything more than a very, very long trumpet indeed. And we know that she's working with Pierre O'Reilly, composer, to create some new work for that evening. And we know that there'll be elements of staging in that concert. I think it'll be a really extraordinary night.
I think it promises a great deal. And let's hear Alison Balsam in action right now with the music of Mozart. She is such a great player. Alison Balsam, together with the Gothenburg Symphony Orchestra, Edward Gardner, the conductor for the aria of the Queen of the Night from Mozart's opera, The Magic Flute. So we've been hearing about the vast array of musical events taking place for the Bristol Proms this year from Tom Morris, who's organising it, the man behind it. Tom, let's talk about the last day, Saturday the 1st of August, because there's a whole array of musical events taking place from dawn till dusk.
Yeah, it's a crazy last day. There's an outreach project we've been running through the summer called The Gift of Music, whereby, working with Sinfonia Cymru, we've sent a string quartet into various primary schools. And it's been a very simple project. We've sent a string quartet into school assemblies and then into classrooms and played music for the children. And any children who enjoyed that experience have been able to write to us and say who they would like to give the gift of this music to, why, and on what occasion and what time and place would be appropriate. And then we've picked 8 of the letters, and those children have come back in to meet the quartet again and talk about what music would be appropriate. So they'll have chosen the music which will be given as gifts. And then the string quartet will turn up and play the gift for the recipient. And all of this is filmed. And then on the Saturday, the children who've given the gift and the people who've received it and the quartet will be there on stage. We'll have some film of that extraordinary process and some live music, really to show the impact that music can have on children and how accessible classical music is. That's the point, really. And then we try to end the Bristol Proms with some sort of memorable event. And this time we're working with the Erebus Ensemble, a wonderful choir, to explore what we're calling 16th century stereo. In other words, wraparound sound in absolutely pure acoustic.
Bristol Proms, looking forward to that enormously. Classic FM is going to be there for all of the week as well. And every event runs from the 27th of July, that's the opening date, until the 1st of August. More details from our website as well, it's classicfm.com. You can also call the Bristol Old Vic box office. It's open right now. This is the number you need. It's 0117 987 7877. Thanks again for downloading this podcast, and I hope you'll join me this coming Sunday from 3 o'clock, when my guests will include the actor Jake Gyllenhaal.